The following live presentation by Rabbi Benny Friedman is brought to you by Israelite, inspiring a renaissance in Jewish living. To learn more about Israelite, please visit our website at www.israelite.org. Additional contact information is available at the end of this presentation. Thank you for learning with Israelite and enjoy the experience.
My Rebbe, when I was growing up, he was in Yeshiva University taking classes. And there was one particular lecturer who was known to be a very, very hard marker. He was a teacher of Jewish history. He was very tough. And he gave very long lectures. And so gradually, as is the normal process of events at any university, less and less people enrolled for his class. Anyway, this particular... Now, because of the way things were with this particular lecturer, he had tenure, he had seniority, he was well known. So he always traditionally, since the time of his heyday when the lecture hall was full, had a huge lecture hall. And even though now he had less and less students, they never sort of found the way to say to him, you should go sit in a smaller classroom. So he had this huge lecture hall. And this particular semester when Rabbi Riskin enrolled, he was then young Stephen Riskin, for this class, there were three people who enrolled for this class in this huge lecture hall. But to his credit, and this was part of his personality, and I guess the reason some people didn't come to his lectures, he treated it as a full lecture hall. He would come to the lecture hall and he would speak out to the audience. Anyway, one particular day during final season, you know, there's always some student, a student has other finals, a student is sick. Rabbi Riskin came to the lecture hall and he found he was the only student there. It's a huge lecture hall and he was the only student there. So the professor could have come over, sat down next to him, had a schmoz. But this professor, that was his nature, he went up to the lectern, fixed his glasses properly and began to give a lecture. A long lecture. In the middle of the lecture, Rabbi Riskin had to go to the bathroom. He was the only student. What do you do? And this wasn't the type of rapport that you could raise your hand and say, excuse me, could you stop your lecture? I have to go to the bathroom. So finally, he, you know, you gotta go, you gotta go. So he got up and he went to the bathroom. And the lecturer continued to teach. Because that was his nature. So I'm sort of reminded that I see, you know, people, there's a general rule, there are very few students who will sit in the front. Right? So I will chalk this up to your need for circulatory air. If at any point you can't hear me or follow me, stop me. I want to tell you that the topic tonight, you may think that because there was a lecture scheduled, Rabbi Cardoza took ill, and I came to give the lecture, that that's the reason that I'm giving this lecture. The truth is that I've been wanting to give this lecture for a while, and looking for an excuse. And since I knew there were some people who would come tonight, this was my excuse to give this lecture. This is one of the most central issues in Judaism. It is one of the most difficult issues in Judaism. And I am going to open up with you tonight some very difficult windows that I will not close. I may not even mention them because they are so obviously opened by this topic that I will leave you to think about them. And I, in terms of the issue that we're going to discuss this evening, am going to give you a very specific perspective. I remember one of the most difficult moments that I ever had in the army from the perspective of training. You know, the army is divided up into three units. In general, the army, everything is divided by three in the army. Three parts to the gun, three parts to the uniform. Everything is in threes. There are three types of army experiences. There's what's called kursim, to be in a course. And then there's what's called imun, maneuvers. Even when you finish your courses, you do maneuvers again and again. And then there's what's called kav, to be on the line. When I'm up in Lebanon, so I'm not doing maneuvers, I'm on the line. When I'm on maneuvers, so that's different from being in Lebanon. And the beginning, usually, of most army experiences involves itself with courses. So, one of the most difficult course experiences that I had in the army was right at the end of Kurs Ktsinim. This was, it actually took me a year to get my bars. It's a long story in and of itself. And at the end of almost a year, there's one test which will determine whether you, after an entire year of agony, will become an officer or get sent back to the drawing board. And you can imagine that the pressure involved in this particular day of testing and maneuvers, it's actually more than a day of maneuvers. So there's one part of this test that's called a maslul, it's called a maneuver. Literally, you get in a tank, and you have to command three tanks, and you're being graded by the battalion commander and the company commander and whoever else is watching. And this particular maslul is called a maslul ringo. The word ringo really means sort of from the hip. In other words, they don't tell you what you're going to do. Most maneuvers, they say, okay, you're going to do a mountain maneuver. So you go through it on a dry run to make sure that you know that there are no sudden turns, it shouldn't be dangerous. And then you do it again on a wet run with fire and firing shells and everything else, right? But this particular maneuver is called a maneuver, a Ringo maneuver, because you don't know what's going to happen. You don't know where you're going to be. You don't know what's going to come up. You don't know what dilemmas they're going to throw at you. Are you going to have to, you know, are you going to lose one tank in the middle and all of a sudden have to deal with, you know, dividing your fire? Are you going to be wounded? All these different things. And this is a tremendously difficult test, and it's frustrating because you can't do anything to prepare for it because you don't know what it's going to be. So it's basically the sum total of everything you've done over the course of the last 4 months of tank officers training. So you do this test, and by the time I finished this test, I was literally like, you could have wrung me out like a rag. And when you finish this test, they say you know whether you passed. You just know. You either did really well, or you completely messed up. There's no middle ground. So I finished this test, and I knew that I passed. I mean, I did the right things, and it worked out, and there was this tremendous relief, because now you've really finished. And there's technical things that you have to do to finish up, and gear, and cleaning up your tanks, but you just, at that moment, finished Kurs Tzinim, officer's course. And there, you know, the three guys who were grading you were having their little huddle discussion. And when I finished this all, so my Ganan literally means a nursery school teacher or whatever, it's the term they give to the officer who is watching you become an officer, he's your kindergarten advisor. And he comes over and he goes, so, no, I think you passed the test. So I think, okay, this is the most loaded question I'm ever going to be asked. Because if I say no, well then, I don't have the confidence to be an officer. If I say yes, is that arrogant? But I thought about it. I couldn't imagine anything that I would say would change whether or not I passed the test. So I said, yeah, I think I did. Right? So he says, you got it all wrong. He says, now the test begins. Every day when you wake up in the morning and you face your men, that's your test. You don't know if you've passed your test. Because you've got so many tests ahead of you. It's a very powerful line. And I never forgot it. I took it with me wherever I went as an officer. And you start to ask yourself a question, what do I need the tests for? I mean, if I'm officer material, then I'm officer material. And if I'm not, I'm not. So why do I need that test? Makes sense to me. Because I may think I'm officer material, but they don't know that. So the test is geared to determine, is this person someone who we, the Israeli army, feel is capable of doing what an officer is supposed to do, to lead men into battle and whatever else is involved? And that makes a lot of sense. Judaism must have a completely different idea of the concept of a test. And you know why I say that? Because the most famous example where I find a test being given is the example of the binding of Isaac. Akedat Yitzchak. And the way that you will find that that whole portion begins is with an unbelievable statement. Vayehi achar hadvarim ha'ele. And it was after these things. Lehi Elohim nisa et Avraham. And God, and I'm giving an English translation, we're going to have to translate this translation. And God tested Abraham. And what follows is the story of the binding of Isaac. Karachma. Take et bincha, your son, yechidcha, your only son, asher ahavta, the one you love. It's clear that God understands what he's asking Abraham to do. Vehaaleu sham leolah, and offer him up as a whole burnt offering, al echad heharim asher omar elecha, on one of the mountains that I will show you. Very difficult test. You could debate what the test is. You could debate what the value of such a test is. You could debate how God could actually ask of Abraham to do such a thing. But clearly, that's the story. And it's clear that the Torah seems to say that this is a test. So ask me an obvious question. That's not rhetorical. Ask me an obvious question. If you don't have this question already in your head, then I'm lecturing and you're listening and we're not learning together. So ask me an obvious question. What do you mean, why? This has to either totally redefine our perspective on what a test is. How could God possibly need to test anything? God knows. if a test is to determine some piece of information, I test drive a car to see if I want to buy it. So I don't know if it's a good car before I test it. When I test it, I see it is and I buy it. So I don't know something. The test is the vehicle that allows me to ascertain that piece of information. If I test a human being, I don't know where that person is at. Now the test doesn't change where the person is at. Our definition of a test is that the person's already there. The test tells me where there is. That can't be the case with God, because God knows everything. I mean, if there's a God, and all the other assumptions that go along with that, then the Jewish perception of God as a God is unlimited. And if God is unlimited, then God knows. So what's the need for the test? So tell me what you think is the standard answer, because every commentary on the face of the earth who touches this issue asks this question. Because you can't not ask this question when you look at this story. So they all ask this question. And many of the commentaries give the following answer. Tell me what the following answer is. Then I'll know we're really learning. And I'll tell you what they say. And I'll tell you why I bought into it for a long time. And then I'll tell you why I have a problem with it. So what do you think they say? Yeah? Oh, test is not for God. The test is for Abraham. And I could give you a whole lecture on how beautiful an idea that is. How Abraham has this incredible ability, this opportunity to discover who he really is and what potential he has and the strengths that lie deep within him. And that's magnificent. And you could argue maybe that we don't know where we are. And that the purpose of a test is to say to me, look where you are. And that's great. And I could give you a whole test on that. Except it's not true. Or at least I have a problem with it. I can't say something the Ramban says is not true. But I have a problem with it. In fact, I think I even have two problems with it. One I know and one I'm not sure about. First of all, this is very difficult. Because consider what this means. You know, Abe, this is God talking now. I get to teach, so I get to be God. Abe, don't know if you know exactly how wonderful you are, so I'm going to give you a little test. Take your son and offer him up there and slaughter him. Aren't you happy now? Doesn't really make sense. Doesn't fit with my image of God. That just doesn't seem to be a good enough reason for God to do this. I mean, I want to see if my daughter, who's 7 years old, has the ability to deal with a difficult situation. That's a valuable thing to discover. So I put her in a difficult situation to see how she deals with it. That's called child abuse. So that's my first problem with this. It bothers me. And you know, there's a whole perspective that we deal with in our lives that relate to this issue. Because you could argue that all of us undergo tests. And all of us have to wonder, if this test comes from Hashem, comes from God, what is this test for? Where is this test coming from? Why did God need this test? And to say that I'm getting this test to learn that I have the ability to show me where I am, that's terribly depressing. By the way, go a stage further. Who says everybody passes the test? I don't know if you can always define what passing the test is and what failing the test is. Let's take a really extreme example, so extreme that it's arrogant to even bring it up. But again, I get to do that. You take the Holocaust. I mean, this is Abraham's individual Holocaust. So let's say that on this genre, that the Holocaust is such a test. You don't find more difficult tests in this world than that. So how do I define what passing the test is? And however I define what passing the test is, some people pass it and some people don't. And even assuming that we, in this world, maybe even in the next world, but certainly in this world, can't possibly have the arrogance to attempt to ascertain whether someone passed the test and whether someone didn't. Or even to define the Holocaust as a test. But if I define the Holocaust as a test, and if some people don't pass that test, what could possibly be the value of that? So that's a very dangerous philosophy when you stop to think about it. And I've actually heard people say in very difficult situations, especially in dealing with some of the tragedies that I saw in the army particularly, God's giving you a test. Which is just a horrible thing to say. So how do I relate to that? What is the meaning of a test? Now, I'm going to give you a perspective that works for me, that I'm still working on and still processing, that I think is a thought process that's worth being aware of. What you do with this thought process, well, that depends on you. And I can't imagine that any single person in this room will have the exact same direction from this thought process as anybody else. But I think that the thought process itself is a valuable thing. The Ramban, by the way, just to mention one additional perspective that I find not so simple. The Ramban takes what I just said, which I'll momentarily go beyond, and puts it perhaps in a bit of a different light. He says, you know, there's a magnificent verse in the book of Kings. It's interesting, by the way, that the author of this quote, the person who is speaking, is a king by the name of Ahab. Ahab is less than a positive figure in the Bible. He marries Jezebel. He is, by the way, a king of the north, the king of Israel, of the 10 tribes. He is most famous for the fact that he killed off all the prophets, except for Eliyahu, Elijah. He marries a Phoenician princess, who is the epitome of treachery and betrayal and evil, a woman by the name of Jezebel, hence the idiom in the English language. He's responsible for almost an unspeakable act called Kerem Nevot, the vineyard of a man named Nevot, where he steals by loophole legal and not so clean means the vineyard of a man named Nevot. And in general, not the most savory of characters. Eliyahu, Elijah the prophet, tells him off. The Talmud tells me that Ahab has no portion in the world to come. But there are certain positive aspects to Ahab. And it's interesting that after the Talmud says that Ahab has no portion to the world to come, there's a different Talmudic section that says that Ahab is to be met in the world to come. It doesn't make sense. Almost as if to say that in death, Ahab was able to undo the decree against him. Rav Kook, the first chief rabbi of Israel before it was a state, was the chief rabbi of Israel. He was the first, and he was the founder of the concept known as the chief rabbinate during the time that Herzl passed away. Actually, it may be that he became chief rabbi after Herzl passed away. I may be. But those of you who know your history know that Herzl, despite, you know, the fact that he was the father of modern Zionism, the fact that he dreamed about a Jewish state, that you could argue that he was a visionary figure, he was certainly not, by the traditional sense of the word, what we would stereotype as a religious person. And what we stereotype as the religious framework had a big problem with him. He made no bones about who he was. And it didn't bother him to have shrimp at the convention in Basel. It was, in fact, Herzl who attempted to push through a suggestion that the state of Israel be in Uganda. Because what motivated him was not necessarily the holiness, the sanctity of the land of Israel, but the brotherhood of the Jewish people. So when Herzl died, there were many who felt that he shouldn't be eulogized. Rav Kook vehemently disagreed. He eulogized Theodor Herzl, and you can find a part of the text of this eulogy in a commentary on the Book of Kings called the Dat Mikra, which unfortunately, to the best of my knowledge, only exists in Hebrew. And he quotes the story of Ahav's death. How did Ahav die? Ahav, who supposedly barely did anything good in his life. Ahav went to war against the kingdom of Aram. And it was a war that the prophets told him not to go, that he wouldn't succeed. It was being fought for the wrong reasons. The motivation wasn't clear. The Jewish people were idolatrous. It didn't work. But Ahav went to war. The Arameans understood that if they killed Ahav, the battle would be theirs. So they managed to locate the chariot of the king, and they succeeded in hitting Ahav. And Ahav was mortally wounded by an arrow. Ahav understood that if he fell in his chariot, that the Jewish people would see this, that they would lose hope in the battle, and they would be routed. He was urged by his men to leave the scene of the battle. because he needed to recoup and survive. He was mortally wounded. And he refused to leave the scene of the battle. And he had his men hold him up in the chariot in order that the Jewish people shouldn't see that he was mortally wounded and lose the day. Ultimately, Achav dies of his wounds. But the Jewish people carry the day. And the kingdom of Israel survived. Says Rav Kook, from various references, this was the act that gave Achav the right to enter the Garden of Eden. Because in his death, he demonstrated such an intense love for the Jewish people, a willingness to suffer and to die for the Jewish people, that overcame all the evil he'd done in his life. Tremendous idea. And said Rav Kook, and you can argue whether this fits Herzl, says Rav Kook, whatever you say about Theodor Herzl, here's a man who was motivated by so much care and motivation, who literally gave up his life because he worked himself into the grave at a very young age because of his motivation and his journeys and his travels for Zionism, motivated purely out of a love for the Jewish people. He says, anyone who doesn't see tremendous sanctity in such a person doesn't understand what the Torah wants of us. Tremendous idea, Rav Kook. So Achav says an unbelievable line. Achav was also the king of the one-liners. He had a couple of really good ones. And he's having this sort of letter conversation with the king of Aram. And the king of Aram sends word, you know, we're going to go to war, we're not going to go to war, you better watch out because I'm coming, I'm bringing my soldiers. And Achav sends back Vayan, this is in Malachim Aleph, Kings 1, chapter 20, verse 11. Vayan Melech Yisrael Vayomer. And the king of Israel, Achav, and it's interesting, it doesn't call him Achav, because right now he's speaking as the king of Israel. You get a sense in the book of Kings that when Achav speaks as the king of Israel, he rises to the occasion. The responsibility. Vayomer Dabaru Al Yithalel Choger Kimfateach. Let not him that girds on his armor boast as he that takes it off. As brave as you think you are, O Aramean king, there's a big difference between he who has yet to put the armor on and he who's taking it off. In other words, however great I am, if my great am is still potential am, it can't be as great as actual am. In other words, the test, says the Ramban of Moshe ben Nachman, Nachmanides, 13th century, is to bring out my potential. It's to take the potential that lies within me and to make it actual. Because action that is actual is much greater than potential. And that's also a magnificent philosophy. But again, I have a problem with that. Why? Why do I need that? If the only people in the room are me and God, and if I have the potential to be the Abraham of the binding of Isaac, then why does God have to bring it into action? It's already there. The fact that I can do this tells me that I'm already there. So what difference if it's in potential or not? I want to tell you something. My brother was one of the most difficult stories in our family, militarily. My brother was a paratrooper. He was in the 202 Battalion, and when he was about 6-7 months in the army, he was in Beirut, and they went into a refugee camp. You may have heard of the story of Sabra and Shatila. This is about, 15 years ago. It's a terrible story. There was a tremendous massacre of Palestinian refugees in two camps in Lebanon, not far from Beirut, just before or just after, I don't remember anymore, Rosh Hashanah in 1982. Over 900 civilians, women, children were killed, butchered, and the world went bananas. Because the killing took place in the jurisdiction of the Israeli army. And the Israeli army didn't perpetrate the killings. Christian Falangim, who were the sworn mortal enemies of the PLO, for very good reason, perpetrated the killings. But it was all done in the area that was officially under the jurisdiction of Israel. So Israel got taken to task. I remember speaking at the time to groups when I was on leave, you know, meeting like summer tours, finding out that people really thought that Israelis had done the killing because, you know, that's just the way, you know, it's easy to read things without reading things. Anyway, there was a whole commission. and the chief of staff was forced to resign, the defense minister was forced to resign, because even though we didn't do the killings, we should have predicted it. We should have been aware of what might happen if Christian Falun soldiers entered the camps, and we should have thought, we can't allow them in there, and we didn't. And that alone was enough to court-martial the chief of staff, and to cause the chief of the defense minister to resign. Now that's an incredible statement about Israel, about a Jewish state. It's a tremendous idea when you stop to think about it. The reason why the Israelis allowed or turned a blind eye to Christian Falun soldiers entering the camps was because of the story that my brother went through 3 days before. They had sent a unit in. It was clear that these camps were full of PLO terrorists. They were, it's funny, you know, today that's not in vogue, but then it was. And they went in to clean it out. And he was a younger unit. They were only 6-7 months in the army. And they were supposed to be the backup unit. But the PLO circled around and either realized or didn't realize, but surrounded their unit. My brother was actually commanding an APC, an armored personnel carrier, because there weren't enough commanders. So he was the guy in the turret. And he saw the APC in front of him blown up and his lieutenant blown up into the air and killed. The APC in back of him was also destroyed by an RPG, because that was the tactic, to bottle up the enemy. And in that time, they managed to clamber out of their APC. They were completely surrounded and completely ambushed. And just about all the officers were killed, most of the sergeants. So they found themselves, a very young unit, in the middle of a refugee camp, surrounded by terrorists, only 7 months in the army. They didn't know exactly where they were. Most of them, because they were still young soldiers, couldn't yet read map coordinates well enough to tell division command, even if they knew how to call division command, where they were. So they sat in this alley for some 4 hours until finally they were able to get them out. I remember one of the things my brother told me made a strong impression on me, because it affected the way I thought in terms of what I felt I needed to prepare myself for as an officer. Said that there was one sergeant that he had that had survived, but basically, you know, there were X number of sergeants and officers in the unit and everybody else was gone. And this sergeant couldn't handle it. And it was the first time that all of them were under fire. Because before the 82 war, it was 73, these guys were all in high school. And this guy couldn't handle it. And he completely lost it. He threw down his gun, started to scream, started to cry. My brother said the point at which real fear overtook him was when he saw his sergeant completely lose him. And he understood now what a deep mess they were in. You don't know how you're going to be until you're there. That doesn't mean that you ever want to know. Because however you're going to be when you're there is how you're going to be. And it isn't that the act of being there is going to allow you to become that. You either have it or you don't. And there's no way of knowing. So what could be the value in that? Why does God need to bring the potential action of Abraham out into an actual form? What possible value could there be? So now that I think we have the question clear, I want to give you an amazing perspective. And this perspective is one which I think affects every aspect of our lives in every moment of our lives. And this is a line that I actually came to through a Rebbe of mine, Rav Bick. And I've you know, done a lot of thinking about it. And it's really quoted by the Chassidei Kreskas, who was a medieval commentator, who wrote a magnificent book called The Or Hashem. There's a section in The Or Hashem, The Light of God, on divine providence and free will, Bechira Chofshit. And in that section, he discusses this story, and he says something which has a slight nuance of difference. But that different nuance is enough to turn this whole picture on its ear. And I want to just, as we get into this, I want you to understand that this bar none is one of the most important stories in Judaism. You know, we studied Torah. And one of the most tragic things is to see people study this book as a text without understanding what a living text it is and how much it affects who we are. We read this story in addition to the portion of the week when it comes around in the fall, every day as a part of the morning blessings. This is the Torah reading on Rosh Hashanah. As a matter of fact, the ta'amim, the cantillations, the tunes, you know, every word in the Bible, in addition to having vowels, also has a tune, what's called ta'amim. In fact, my daughter, my oldest daughter, goes to a school where they teach them Torah through music. It's a magnificent system. And they teach them the tunes for the verses, and they sing them. And in the process of singing these verses, they memorize them. And my daughter knows whole sections of Torah by heart, because she can sing them. It's a wonderful, wonderful thing. And so by the time she's ready to begin analyzing the meaning of these verses, she's going to be light years ahead of where I was, because she'll know all the verses in here to be able to compare and analyze, etc. So there's a whole different section of tunes for Rosh Hashanah, for the High Holy Days, because music affects mood. And the mood of the day on Rosh Hashanah is different. And the tune for this particular story is such a magnificent tune. And I think what the rabbis were doing when they set this up was that this tune should somehow, it should be so powerful it stays with you. V'hai Elohim Nisa et Avraham. It's a powerful, powerful tune. And the reason we read it on Rosh Hashanah is because it's such a basic part of Judaism. So, I don't want anybody to have a misunderstanding. It's not that I have this idea, which I think is important, but I'm using this incidental story as an example. This story is set up as a story that is so important, so basic, that it is the essence of Jewish thought and philosophy. Okay, so here comes the Yor Hashem. Here comes the Chasdei Kreskov. This is such a line. What a line. Hama'asim, actions, yaknu tchuna b'nefesh, will cause one to acquire character in the soul. Let me read that to you again. Hama'asim, actions, yaknu tchuna b'nefesh, will cause one to acquire character in the soul. Kol shekein, and certainly, yichazku et asher kvar nimtza. They will strengthen that which is already there. See, we have an assumption. And our assumption is that we should do what we can do. I am Binny Friedman, in 1997, and where I'm at right now means that I can do X, Y, and Z, so that's what I have to do. Wherever I am, on whatever level I'm at, should determine what I do. But Judaism says something very different. Judaism says that action can actually develop my character. People say all the time, how do I change? How do I change? Let's assume that I've reached an intellectual conclusion that I want to change. And let's assume that I even reach an intellectual conclusion that I know who I want to be. And let's assume even that who I want to be is not that far away from where I am. How do you do that? And you know, you read so many books. You read Jung, and you read Fromm, and you read Kant, and Kierkegaard, and how do I do this? Where's the magic potion? How do I change? How can I think differently? How can I feel differently? How can I look at that person towards whom I have such negative feelings and change the way I think? How can I gain inspiration? How do you do that? You see sometimes people, they're so inspired, and you want to be inspired. How do I do that? So I try to think differently, and I focus, and I meditate, and I wonder, and I soul search, and I go to the Rebbe, or the psychiatrist, or whoever it is. Jesus says, listen, take a chill pill. That's not what it is. You know how you change? What's inside? Change what's outside. Because the way you behave will affect the way you are. In fact, there's an unbelievable verse in the story of the Akedah, of the Binding of Isaac. God says at the end an unbelievable line. He says, Atayadati, he says, she says, it says, Atayadati, now I know. Ki yirei Elohimata. That you are, we spoke at Israelite once about what the concept of yirah, yirat Elohim. People translate that as the fear of God. I'm not so sure that's correct. Yirah is the same root as ri'iyah, to see. Now I understand that you have an awareness of me, that you are so aware of me, that you have such a relationship with me, that you can do this thing. That's what he's saying. That's what yirat Hashem is. Awe of God, awareness of God, seeing that God's really there, and the implications of that. Okay, so God says, now I know that you've got this. So what does that mean? The Briyot. What do you mean, now I know? What you didn't know before? So all the traditional commentaries that are going along the lines, as I was discussing before, will say, now you've brought it out. In other words, the Rambam, for example, Maimonides, in the Guide to the Perplexed, says, Atayadati, Atahodati. Now I have let it be known. I have, through this process of the binding of Isaac, caused the world to see who you are. If the purpose of Judaism, if the purpose of Abraham, of the first Jew, is to become such an incredibly good, ethical human being, that the whole world wants to learn from him, not that he has to go teach the world, but that his goodness is so great that you can't help but want to learn from him. So this is an important aspect of that process. Now the world sees what it means to be aware of God. So putting aside the philosophical question of why the binding of Isaac and what that means, that's how the Rambam understands. But the Chaste Kreskas in the Or Hashem that I just read you the quote from has a whole different perspective. Now I know you have this level. You didn't have it before. You weren't there before. By doing this, you got there. And you really weren't there before. What does this mean? This is a tremendous thing. How does this work? If this is true, if Abraham is now at a level that he wasn't at before, and if that's a good thing, and if the binding of Isaac's story contains the secret of how I can get from this level to this level, then that's an incredibly important message. How does that work? How do you do that? How did he do that? What was the... So the Sefer Achinuch, the Book of Knowledge, is a book that goes through all the mitzvot in the Torah. This is actually a text I didn't mention for those of you at Israelite in class today because I knew I would mention it tonight. We don't really know exactly who the author is. There's some debate about it. But he goes through the portions of the week and he analyzes each mitzvah, what it means, what the philosophy of it is. He's not interested, for the most part, in the halakha, in the technical laws. He's interested in what I'm supposed to do with this, what it's supposed to do for me. And it's a magnificent book. And he prefaces it by saying that there are those who will think that it's a mistake to try to understand what God wants us to do, because I should just do it if I know that there's a God. And if I have faith in God, then by definition, I'm going to do what God wants me to do because I have faith in God. I shouldn't need to know why God tells me to do something. And you will find many people with all the best intentions who will tell you this. What does it matter why we celebrate Shabbat? We celebrate Shabbat because God says celebrate Shabbat. Now, notwithstanding the fact that the reason that I celebrate Shabbat is because I ultimately believe that it's something that God wants me to do, and notwithstanding that there's a challenge to decide how I arrive at that conclusion, the Chinuch says a person who lives only with that philosophy is missing the boat. In fact, he quotes a verse. He says, to them I say, "Ksil b'choshech yalech." It's a verse, if I'm not mistaken, from the book of Proverbs. A fool walks in darkness. Now, do you want to live on blind faith alone? That's all this mitzvah is going to mean to you? That you do it because God told you to do it? Then you're a fool. That's a nice way of saying, idiot! Because there's so much more that a mitzvah can mean to you. So the Chinuch is talking about the mitzvah of tzedakah, charity. I actually mentioned this week at Israel. And he says, we don't give tzedakah. Tzedakah, by the way, doesn't mean charity. That's a big mistake. Because charity means that I'm doing something even though I don't have to do it. The Jewish perception of tzedakah is from the root word tzedek, justice. I give tzedakah because that's what I'm supposed to do. That's what I was given the money for, to give it to others, whatever percentage I have to give. It's a different idea. So I'll call it tzedakah because I don't know that there's an accurate English translation. But I don't give tzedakah to the poor because they need the money, says the Chinuch. If the only reason that I gave tzedakah to the poor people was because they needed the money, so if they needed the money, God would get them the money. God has more than enough money. And God can find more money. And God won't get pressured about how much money there is. So it's not because they need the money. The reason I give tzedakah to the poor people is because it allows me to be giving tzedakah. Because acting mercifully makes me a merciful person. If you look in the first Mishnah of Ethics of the Fathers, it's really the second Mishnah. What a magnificent Mishnah. Shimon HaTzadik, Shimon the Righteous, one of the last remnants of the men of the Great Assembly. This is someone who lived at the beginning of the period of the Mishnah, which was probably around 330 or so BCE, just the time of Alexander the Great. But someone who nonetheless somehow sat on the men of the Great Assembly, he walked with prophets. He knew Daniel of the lion's den, and Mordechai of the Purim story, and Haggai and Zephaniah and Malachi. So you're talking about someone, and he says, what's the world based on? Three things, right? Ala Torah, on Torah, the Ala Avodah, and on service, whatever that means, prayer, my relationship and what I'm supposed to do with God, the Al Gmilut Chasadim, and on acts of loving kindness. So I once saw a magnificent commentary by a guy by the name of Irving Bunim. Irving Bunim writes one of the best working commentaries on Ethics of the Fathers I've ever seen. It's called Ethics from Sinai. It's a 2 or 3 volume set, and it's magnificent. And if you want to see what it looks like, come by the Israelite Beit Midrash. We have a copy there. You can come sit and study it. And he says a tremendous thing. He says, you know, why does it say Gemilut Chasadim, plural, acts of loving kindness? Torah is in the singular. Avodah, service, is in the singular. So it should say Chesed, kindness. He says, because Chesed has 2 sides to it. Best expressed by Portia in her soliloquy in A Merchant of Venice. Mercy is a quality twice blessed. It blesseth him that gives and him that takes. Because when I give tzedakah, I get as much as I give. The act of giving is giving me, because I'm becoming better. So how does this work? And this is, I want you to know, a tremendous idea. Before the Akedah, before the binding of Isaac, Avraham is not on the level of the Akedah. He's not on that level. By doing the action, he literally pulls himself up. In other words, if I want to become a merciful person, I can do 2 things. I can go the hard way or the easy way. The hard way, and I'll be honest with you, I don't know that this works, is to study all about mercy. I'll open up all the books that I can find, which talk about the beauty of mercy, the quality of mercy. And I'll ask people to give me lectures on mercy. And I'll talk to people who are merciful, and I'll become all excited about mercy, and I'll just learn about mercy and become merciful. That's not what Judaism says. And that's not what Judaism wants. And that's a much more difficult way to do it, if you ever get there. Judaism says, you want to learn how to be merciful? Just be merciful. Because if you be merciful, you'll become merciful. If you keep giving tzedakah, you'll become a generous person. If you want to develop concentration in prayer, how do you develop concentration in prayer? That's a very difficult thing to do. How do you do that? So you think, well, okay, I'm going to study the meaning of prayer. It's true. And I'm going to study the beauty of prayer, and I'm going to watch people who pray. Jesus says, you know what? If you want to develop concentration in prayer, what you really have to do is pray. It doesn't mean, by the way, and people misunderstand this, it doesn't mean Shema Yisrael, it doesn't mean go through the ritual of prayer. It means you have to pray. Because if you pray, you will learn concentration in prayer. Now, I want you to know what this means. This means that what Judaism wants of me to do is to practice hypocrisy. Is to fake it. In other words, I'm not really on the level of the Binding of Isaac yet. How do I get to be on that level? By behaving as though I were on that level. And when I behave as though I'm on that level, by the time I'm finished, I'm on that level. In other words, what is the image that comes from this story? Here I am, and I'm Abraham. determined to find a way to stop being a hypocrite. Right? We would go to, you know, I was in a yeshiva high school, and we'd wake up every morning, and we would go to pray. That's what we did. And we said all the words and did it all right. And you can imagine, it's very hard to wake up in the morning, have this incredible intent prayer experience when you're 16 years old. So at a certain point, I started saying to myself, you know what, this is ridiculous. I'm coming here every day because that was the school's requirement. Put aside for the moment the absurdity of requiring a person to come to prayer. That's an interesting dilemma, but okay. You will pray now! And I'm sitting there every day and I'm saying all these words because that's what we all did. And at a certain point I say, you know, I'm not getting anything out of this. This is a waste. So I start to look at why I'm not getting enough out of this experience. And it occurs to me after deep and penetrating analysis that one problem might be that during the period of time of the silent prayer, right, I'm having the best time of my day. Why? Because we're exchanging everything about the previous night's Knicks game, which is very important. I mean, Wolf Frazier. There's God and there's Wolf Frazier. And at that stage in my life, I don't know, right? So I decide, okay, if I'm going to develop a relationship with prayer, a healthy thing to do might be stop talking during prayer. Right? It's kind of hard to have this incredible, intense experience if you're in the middle of a conversation. So I decide, you know, I'm going to try this. Right? Now, this might seem like a pretty obvious conclusion, but for a 16-year-old, or at least the 16-year-old that I was, this was like a radical thought process. Okay? So I say, okay, I'm going to try to stop talking during this silent, you know, the repetition of the silent prayer and see what that does for me. Okay, now you got this problem. Why? Because up until then, you know, it's the silent prayer, and you finish whatever saying your silent prayer. Nobody talked during that, because then the teachers would just wipe you out, right? And then the cantor, the chazan, the person leading the prayers, is repeating them all. If you've ever been in a prayer service, you know what I mean, and if not, don't worry. And sort of that's our opportunity to say, catch Frazier's move last night, man, killer, right? That's what we did. There was this humble mumble. And I'm always wondering if the rebbeim, if the rabbis sort of thought everybody was like, sort of with the chazan. You know, we were all together mumbling, right? But we weren't. So I come in the next day, I'm all excited, I'm going to try this out, I'm not going to talk during prayer. But of course, here's the problem, right? Because what am I going to do? Somebody's going to come over and say, hey, check out Dr. J's move last night. What do I say? Right? So you know what the reaction is. Oh, check it out, guys! It's been the rabbi! Ooh, what's the matter? Don't talk now during prayers! Whoa! So I knew that wouldn't work. And I tried it a couple times, right? And I just, you know, I couldn't bring myself to say to my buddies, like, shh, right? Because I'm 16 and they would kill me, right? So I came up with a solution. You know what my solution was? I decided that I would pretend that I was really into it. Because if I pretended I was really into it, then they wouldn't bother me. How do you pretend you're really into it? Well, you close your eyes, right? So, at the end of the Shemona Esrei, at the end of this silent Amidah, when the cantor starts saying the prayers, and the guys are all schmoozing, I'm like this. Now, you can't go over to a guy who's standing like this and start a conversation with him, right? Because you look like an idiot, right? So, this worked. Now, what was I doing? How did I finally, you know, conclude this issue? I had to fake it. It's the only thing that worked. So here I'm faking this intense prayer experience, and I know that it's all a joke. Because I'm still listening to them. And I'm not there yet. But then the most amazing thing happened. Because after a period of time of doing this, something changes. You are involved in an action, and the action has the ability to affect who you are. Now I have to be honest with you. Part of me is still processing this because I can't 100% define for you why this happens. But it does. It's an unbelievable thing. And it's very interesting. Because there are a number of points that have to be made about this process of, let's say, faking it. First of all, it seems that Judaism wants a little bit of hypocrisy. But it doesn't want too much hypocrisy. In other words, it seems clear to me that this process works when the leap that I'm making is not too great a leap. If I'm Abraham here, and I'm trying to get there, it works. But if I'm trying to get all the way over there, it doesn't work. Because I'm not ready for that there. I'll tell you how I know this. Take the story of Abraham. The Bible tells me that there are 10, actually it's a midrash, and it's also mentioned at the beginning of Pirkei Avot, Ethics of the Fathers, or no, 5th chapter, that there are 10 nisyonot, there are 10 tests that Abraham goes through. The first one is the test to go to Israel. Or some would argue the fact that when he gets to Israel, there's a famine and he has to leave and go to Egypt. And he has these 10 tests. his nephew's taken captive, all sorts of different tests. He has to find a bride for his son, whatever it is. The Akedah, the binding of Isaac, is the 10th test. The reason that it's not the first test is because he's not ready for it. Because when he gets to Israel to begin with, he's not anywhere near there. And if I try to jump, if I fake it regarding something that is so far away from me, then it can't affect me because I don't relate to it. It's not close enough for me to have a relationship with it. You understand that? That's very important. And I'll be honest with you, I don't know how to define what is the distance that works and what is the distance that doesn't work. It could be that if this process is something you're involved in and you see you're not getting anywhere, maybe it's because you're taking too much of a leap. You want to understand why I believe it's so important that in all areas of life, and particularly in the area of developing a relationship with who I am, with my Jewish identity with God, there has to be a gradual process. Because it has to be climbing stairs. I can't be cliff climbing. It doesn't work. So that's the first issue. Second issue that's worth mentioning is that this process works for every aspect of life that I can think of, except for one. And that is Torah study. You can't fake being a Torah scholar. It doesn't work. You can't fake being a Torah scholar. The only way to be a Torah scholar is to be a Torah scholar. And the only way to get to be a Torah scholar is to study and study and study and study. However, notwithstanding that, I will tell you a different idea I heard from one of my teachers, which is that there, even within the area of Torah study, there is this aspect. The Rambam, Maimonides, trying to remember if it's the third or the fifth chapter of the Laws of Talmud Torah, says a tremendous thing. He says there are three crowns of aristocracy in the world of Judaism. There is the crown of priesthood, there is the crown of kingship, and there is the crown of Torah study, Torah scholarship. He says the first crown, the crown of priesthood, is available only to the seed of Aaron. I can't be a priest unless I'm born of Kohanim, of priests. The second crown, the crown of kingship, is a crown that's only open, at least legitimately, to those from the seed of King David, of the tribe of Judah. If I'm a Levite, I can't be a king. I may make myself a king, but halachically speaking, I can't be a king. But the crown of Torah, well, that's something which is munach. It's set before every Jew. Every human being can achieve this. So that's very interesting. Because it appears that there's a difference between being a Talmud Chacham, a Torah scholar, and having the crown of Torah. And the Rambam Maimonides doesn't explain what the difference between these two things is. It's not clear. But there is a difference. And I'll tell you how I understand it. Let's say that I reach a conclusion that I am not going to be what's called in the yeshiva world a Gadol Hador, the greatest Torah scholar of the generation. You could argue it could be that Rav Moshe Feinstein passed away a number of years ago in the last generation, if not the, certainly was one of the Gadolei Hador, greats of the generation. The Chafetz Chaim, 80 years ago, one of the greats of the generation. So I say to myself, you know what? I'm Benny Friedman. I'm very happy. I'm trying to become better. I'm trying to grow. But I'm not going to be the Gadol Hador. I'm not going to be the leader of world Jewry, the greatest Torah scholar that lives in the land of Israel. I'm not going to be that. So I don't know, by the way, if halachically you can say that. That's an interesting question. To accept the fact that you can't be that. That's an interesting question. But let's assume I could say that. I'm not going to be a Gadol Hador. It doesn't mean that I can't grow in Torah. So I say to myself, you know, the mitzvah, the opportunity, the commandment, whatever you want to call it, for Torah study, it doesn't say I have to study 28 hours a day. It doesn't say that every waking moment of my life I have to study. That's a wonderful thing. And that's what a Torah scholar is. It just says, Vagitabo Yomam Valayla, you have to have a moment of Torah study in your day and a moment of Torah study in your night. So let's say I say to myself, you know what, I'm going to find an hour in my day to study and an hour in my night. And that's incredible. That's more than what most people do. 2 hours a day of Torah study. Tremendous. When I do that, and I begin to study Torah, so I'm still a travel agent, a businessman, a lawyer, or whatever it is. But I now live in the world of Torah. And because I live in the world of Torah, I take upon myself the crown of Torah. I become a prince of Torah. I become one of the aristocracy of Torah. And when I become the aristocracy of Torah, when I'm someone who is living that life, that Torah life, whatever it is, well, that carries with it certain aspects and certain issues. How do I become that? So I can either do it and become it,
or I can act it and therefore be it. In other words, I can say, I want to be the type of person who is living a Torah life and studying Torah. So I go to a class in Torah, even though I don't want to be there. And I pretend to pay attention, even though I don't want to pay attention. So I'm faking it to a certain extent. So I'll never be a Torah scholar that way, a Talmud Chacham. But I'll be a prince of Torah that way. Because I'm living in the world of Torah. And let's finish up. I want you to understand what this idea means. What the perception of this is. This means that what we learn from this story, when God is testing Abraham, is that God is giving Abraham somehow the opportunity to become, not who he is today, but who he is tomorrow. And God says to me, I don't want you to behave as Benny Friedman today. I want you to behave as Benny Friedman tomorrow. Tomorrow, I want you to be behaving as Benny Friedman the next day. Don't try to behave as Benny Friedman next year, because that's not real. You have to be real. I remember I mentioned this recently, I don't remember where. Rav Amital, my Rosh Yeshiva, they say of him, I had a teacher who told me this from someone he heard, that he, when he was in yeshiva, he used to curl up with rabbinic commentaries, like you and I curl up with a good book. Go to sleep with a whole pile of achronim. You know, the Shach, and the Taz, and the Chafetz Chaim, and he'd just get into bed, you know, all excited, like, you know, curl up with a good Chafetz Chaim. So I'll be honest with you. I'm not there yet. I like Seinfeld. Baruch Hashem. So if I fake being there, that's a dangerous thing to do. Because I'm not real. There's even, by the way, a concept of false pride, what's called yoreh. There's certain halachot which forbid me to act in certain ways because it can be interpreted as me doing something to make it look a certain way. For example, there's a Mishnah that says that a chatan, a groom, we have a soon-to-be chasen in the room, that a groom is not supposed to lahalacha say kriyat shema the night of his wedding. That's what it says. So the Mishnah says, Rabbi Gamliel, the night he got married, he said kriyat shema. Why? Because he couldn't live without Kriyat Shema. How could you go at night without accepting upon yourself the yoke of heaven and God, whatever? It's tremendous. So the halacha says, you're not supposed to say Kriyat Shema the night of your wedding. You know why? You're a false pride. Because you're not Rabbi Gamliel. And don't make everybody think, I mean, presumably he's talking about doing this in front of a congregation at the night of your wedding, right? So you shouldn't say it. Now, by the way, just as an aside, we today do say Kriyat Shema the night of the wedding because our general level, the idea there, was that Kriyat Shema required such intense devotion, saying the Shema, that I couldn't possibly reach that on the night of my wedding. Rabbi Gamliel was capable of doing it, even though he was focused on his wedding, of devoting himself to God. Since today, anyway, we don't reach that level, so we can do it on the night of our wedding. But that's an example. And there are many other examples. And it's very important, the motivation behind this process. And I recently was in a, we're just about done, I recently was in a synagogue, and I was watching a guy who made me dizzy. He just made me dizzy. I don't know if you've ever seen something like this. He was standing like this. That's how he was davening, right? I never saw anybody do it that way. I'm sure he needs someone to help him with scoliosis, but it was unbelievable. And I'm not exaggerating. For every part of davening, for every part of the prayer service, right? You know, like I'm saying, you know, I'm saying the silent Amidah, whatever. And I guess we get affected by the teachers we see and the images we see, and that's how we sort of view as the direction. So when I daven, I think, you know, so I don't do that. You know, I close my eyes and I try to think, and you're not supposed to even be thinking about how you're moving, and sometimes you are, it's just whatever. This guy, mile a minute. Right? Now, if that's what you're doing, okay, so there's two possibilities for that action. One possibility is, I'm not there yet. I have no intention of prayer. I don't know what the heck is going on. I know one verse, and I want to try to get there, but I'm not there yet. So, let's try. Let's just get into it, because maybe if I do this enough and I try to be into it, maybe eventually I'll get into it. That's legitimate. If it is close enough to where I am. And if after a long period of time you see nothing's happening, that's because you're searching for something you're not ready for. But if I'm doing this so that everybody else sees I'm into it, well then I missed the boat. That's the idea of the Akedah. And I get these opportunities in my life all the time. And every time I have this opportunity for action, for a mitzvah, it's an opportunity to pull myself up, to find out what's in me and bring it out. Not because I want the potential to turn into reality, but because I'm not there yet and this brings me up. Now, there's a downside to this. Because this is so, well, what's the result of successfully passing a test? You get another test, more difficult. So maybe I don't want to pass the test. I don't want to be two levels above where I am now. I don't want an Akeda. I don't think anybody here wants to have God command them to bind their son up. So maybe better that I shouldn't pass test. In fact, maybe I'll fail a test. And I'll have easier tests. Of course, the only problem with that is if I do that, I'm dead. Because then I'm not living. Because I'm not growing. Back to the idea of Nisayon. When it says, V'hai Elohim Nisai et Avraham, and God tested Abraham, it uses the word for God which represents din, justice, the difficult part of life. Because the process of this story is how God gives us opportunities to grow. So even though I don't get reward for a test, I do get reward. It's my next test. Because my next test is an opportunity to grow. One last thing and we'll finish. Don't anybody here misunderstand me. God forbid that any of us should ever have the goal or the audacity or the presumption to go over to someone else and tell them how lucky they are that they got a test because now they're grown. That would be beyond chutzpah. That would be stupidity. And go over to someone, God forbid, who lost a leg, lost a son. What a great gift. Because if you lost a son, that must mean you're at an incredible level. Because you're capable of handling this test, and now you can grow, yelling. No. That's not for me to say. The whole idea here is how I look at my own life experiences. Can I find the reserve of energy to look at the difficult parts of life, because we will all have difficult parts of life, as an opportunity to grow? Sometimes it's very easy. Sometimes it's very, very hard. We don't know how we'll deal with it. It could be your kid's cold. It could be running out the door already late for work and having your child vomit all over your suit, which is a wonderful experience. Or it could be, God forbid, a near-fatal car crash and lying in a hospital thinking to yourself, what am I doing here? That's the story of the Akeda. And that's the challenge. Can we find within ourselves the reserves to make ourselves better? Because when we make ourselves better, we make the world better. And that's ultimately the reason that we're here. Yehi Ratzon, God should grant us, each of us, that whatever we have in our lives, whatever difficulties we will find, that we find the reserves of energy to be able to overcome them, to be able to grow from them, and ultimately to be able to give those around us what we've gained from them.
This presentation by Rabbi Benny Friedman has been brought to you by Israelite, inspiring a renaissance in Jewish living. To access additional presentations from our online media library, order our best-selling books, or learn more about Israelite programming, including seminars, web-based learning, teleconferences, spiritual retreats, Shabbaton experiences, Israel missions, and leadership training, please visit us at www.israelite.org. That's www.israelight.org. You can also call us in New York at 212-947-4990 or in Jerusalem at country code 972-627-4890. We hope you enjoyed this presentation, and we look forward to learning with you at Israelite.